Ho there! You're listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network. GBNcom.com. Did you mean to do that?
This is Luke Johnson, the writer who's worked with Wizards of the Coast, White Wolf, Goodman Games, and you're listening to The Tome! Woo!
Welcome to The Tome, Episode 37. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews podcast, and I am your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we will be learning the difference between a fighter and a warlord with 4th edition class update. Welcome again to episode 37 of the Tome 4th Edition Class Update. This show was done with Chris Engler, who gave us some great reviews in the past, and formerly of the Carpe GM podcast. Chris is joining me for several episodes where we chat about the various bits of news that I have gathered only from official sources and providing our commentary along the way. Our discussion was several hours long, and we only got about halfway through my notes on 4th Edition, but I will be releasing those bits as we go along in smaller chunks to make it easier to listen to. Keep in mind that 4th Edition is developing and changing, and we are learning more about it every week. So, if there are any inaccuracies, I just want you to remember that we're working with the information that we had at the time of recording. My philosophy with the news bits we're sharing is quite simple. I'm going to scour the websites, blogs, etc. for news bits so that you don't have to. Or at least you don't have to if you don't want to. If you've already done this, you always still have our commentary to listen to see what two people experienced with the game think about it. Lastly, before we get into the promo and the discussion, let me ask a simple question. As far as promos go, I know some of you really like that I suggest certain shows to you, and I work very hard to make sure that I only play promos for shows that I can personally suggest. And I've been asked to do this on more than one occasion, and I'm happy to. Because I'm happy to be part of the community and to really promote those shows out there that have something to offer. But my question is, would it be better served if I played these promos at the end of the episode, after the main topic but before the conclusion? Or do you like it here at the beginning after the introduction instead? Let me know at thetomeshow@gmail.com, and this will influence how I do things in the future. Now, for this episode's promo. Here's a promo for Heart of the Hunter, a podcast novel written by Sam Chupp, a great friend to RPG podcasters everywhere, and a storyteller with some serious skills. At the end of the promo, you'll have the first part of Chris and I talking about 4th edition. This time, it's all about classes.
From Sam Chupp, co-creator of the role-playing game Changeling the Dreaming, comes a new fantasy novel set in a world over 30 years in the making. Heart of the Hunter is a gritty but fast-paced tale of adventure in the deep forest.
This is why my lovers leave my arms bare. My weapon's bound to my spirit. Got this dagger custom-made, preacher. Balanced, sharp as a pretty boy's tongue, and just as sweet.
Arin the Gypsy, Alibar the Shepherd, Peter the Veteran, and Raven the Sneak Thief must protect a small caravan on its journey from the center of civilization to the icy frontier. The Nail Tongue's number grows daily as their hunting parties plunder further south from the wastes. Winds are changing, yes, and mayhaps now they turn the way we wish. Along the way, they will come to know of a long-lived hatred and an even older power, an ancient talisman known only as the Heart of the Hunter. Let us kill the one who dared kill our own. We will then go to Mother Yulin and add the killer's name to the chant of death as a warning to those who would do such a thing. They don't fight for glory or for honor or revenge. They just want to survive and get paid. The girl's pa was a merchant, right? There'd be a merchant guild bounty. Assurance payments. No doubt. You could letterbox ahead, find out for sure. And how does a mercenary know about assurance payments, pray tell? I can also dance a jig, sir, but it ain't my bread and butter. Come feel the magic and wonder of Koronai, the magical country. This card here, it is the tangled skein. A small thread seems to be nothing, but unravels all. I can only surmise this means there is more to your journey than we can know. Come join the journey. Listen to the audiobook for free at heartofthehunter.com. The song Epic Orchestral Theme is by Rob Vandenberg.
All right, guys, this is Jeff, of course, and I have brought in Chris as a special guest host for this little discussion on 4th edition. Welcome to the Tome, Chris.
Thanks, Jeff. Glad to be here.
And, of course, everybody would recognize Chris from some of the great reviews you sent in. You did an Iron Kingdoms character guide review, and you did the WWE Know Your Role review, if I remember right.
That's correct, yep.
And those were some great reviews, and when I listened to those reviews as I put them into the episodes, and then I heard that Chris was leaving his own podcast behind, I thought this would be a great opportunity to take some of that, you know, free time that you've developed with the lack of podcasting to grab you and get you on the Tome a little bit more.
You're assuming that I didn't fill that free time with other things.
Yeah.
But no, in all seriousness, I'm really thankful for the opportunity because I was just finding – I really enjoyed doing my own podcast, but I found it – the amount of energy it took was unbelievable. So, I mean, that's a testament to guys like you that are able to keep it going. I enjoyed what I came out with, but I'm glad to have a chance like this to keep participating because I guess I like the sound of my own voice enough that I want to record some more stuff. But it's just thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you on, and you know, if things go well and if the schedule works out, maybe we can make a regular thing of it.
Wow, so it's like a job interview, too.
That's right. So we're going to talk a little bit about 4th edition news. I have spent the last several months since the announcement sort of scouring the Wizards website, some of the various articles. At first, I also scoured the blogs and the forums pretty heavily. Just pulling out any little bits of official information. We're not going to be talking about rumors. We're not going to be talking about any of those kinds of things. We're going to be focusing on what we actually know. Now, I've since not hit the forums as heavily in the last month and a half, 2 months, and I've not hit the blogs as heavily in the last month or so when they switched over to Gleemax because it's a lot harder to follow once they did that. But most of the information I found in the time that I was doing all three was all coming out in the most of it was coming out in the articles anyway. And so I think we got some good information here. I've broken it up into different categories, and we're going to go through and not only give you the information, but sort of give you our thoughts about the information and where we think that's going.
It sounds like a great idea. And I just want to preface all my comments with saying, you know, there's a lot of people that I've read forum posts and stuff like that from online that, you know, fancy themselves game designers and they're really not. And I just want to come clean right now and say that, you know, I'm just a consumer and a player of role-playing games. I'm not a game designer. So, you know, my comments are all going to be in that context. So
Right. Just
don't want to sound like I'm on a higher horse than I ought to be.
Sure. And I'm sort of in that same boat, of course. And I would also preface all of this by saying that, this is all, of course, subject to change. Nothing has been released. Nothing, you know, none of the books are out yet. And so if something we say doesn't turn out to be true, I'm sorry, but this is what the information we have at this point. And in whether or not we make any judgment calls about whether we like what we see or not, of course, is also subject to change as the rest of the rules come out. You know, if I say I don't like something, but then later I see it in the whole system, then maybe it'll make more sense and I'll like it all of a sudden. So,
yeah. Well, and even in your own notes, I mean, they're more or less in chronological order. The notes you sent me, and they've already changed some things based on
Sure. Stuff
that's been previously announced. So
yes.
It's a very fluid kind of thing.
Right. Well, let's
which surprises me considering how close they are to delivery date. But anyway, let's get going.
Well, no, that's absolutely true. I've talked to – and you see from people, and I've talked to people, and they're like, oh, well, everything's got to be set in stone. They can't be changing anything right now. Everything's – I mean, they've got to be sending it out to the printer any day now. But at the same time, they keep talking about getting in playtest reports and all that kind of stuff. So I think things are starting to solidify, but I don't know if if things are in their final stage, even at this point, maybe I can get some Wizards folks on the horn in a couple of weeks and see what they say.
Right, because, I mean, when I look at the other – now, I mean, they're in a different tier, but, I mean, do you know this? Are they getting it produced stateside, or are they going to China like most of the companies that I've heard of?
I have no idea how their manufacturing, how their print process works.
Because the general information I have, in just based on what I've heard from other gaming companies, is that you can get stuff printed faster in the U.S., but it's more expensive. So
sure.
A lot of them, like, you know, will go to China where it's significantly cheaper to get it, but you have to wait a lot longer. So perhaps they've got a printing solution that's local that they don't have those logistical delays.
Yeah, that might be. I don't know. I mean, they do have a large company backing them, so I imagine that maybe Hasbro has some printing facilities of their own, and they can just do it all in-house. I'm not sure how it works for them. Again, I've been chit-chatting with some folks over at Wizards, so maybe I can make sure to ask them what that process is like if I can ever actually arrange an interview, which I've tried to schedule one three or four times now, and communication has broken down a couple of times on those. So maybe I can get them on in the next couple of weeks and actually get some of that figured out.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know.
Well, let's go ahead and jump right in. The first category of fourth edition news that I have in my big, long, seven-page listing of notes is the class news, so information about how the different classes are going to work and that kind of stuff. I have annotations as far as which specific game designer released the information for all of those. It's probably not important to the listeners so much to hear a lot of that, so if you're curious who said what, then you can always email me and I'd be happy to share that information with you, but I have it mostly just there to, so if somebody comes back and yells at me, I can, you know, back myself up a little bit. So the first bit of class news we have is that they are looking heavily at this idea of roles in classes, and we're going to talk later about with monsters also. And the roles that they've designed for classes is the leader role, the defender role, striker, and controller, and that each of the classes will fit into one of those roles in some way, shape, or form.
Now, it's interesting to me that they say there's classes and there's roles, and they're saying that each of those classes fits into one of those roles.
Yeah, and I don't know.
Because to me, why make a distinction?
Right.
Unless you can have, which I think would be good, and I think it would enrich the experience, if you can have, you know, a rogue be the leader. Whereas, you know, I would think it would be handcuffing your players and stifling their creativity if you said, okay, this is the fighter. The fighter's the leader.
Right.
Well, what if you have a really charismatic cleric, or a bard? Even I mean, well, I guess bard's not a core class anymore. But you know what I mean? Like somebody that's in a different character class, but you know, has the leadership qualities. And you know,
sure.
I mean, that comes down to the idiosyncrasies of the players too. Like you may have a player that's in real life rather timid and, you know, likes to fade into the background. But when he plays role-playing games, he likes to play fighters. Well, he might like to play a fighter because he likes to, you know, get in there and kick butt, but he might not want to be the leader. So
sure.
I would wonder how they're going to handle stuff like that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I'm thinking along some of the same lines, some of the things that I hear about with the fourth edition and with the idea of roles showing up so often that actually sort of bothers me a little bit is that it seems to be a limiting factor. You know, why if I'm playing a class that is in the leader role, why do I need, you know, why can't I make that same class do something different? You know, I liked the flexibility that you sort of had in earlier editions, you know, in my 3.5 campaigns, I've had classes or parties go for a long period of time without any clerics. You know, they didn't have a healer. They didn't have somebody in that role. But they still were able to get by and improvise by having a rogue with a high use magic device skill and a bunch of wands, you know, so they could get by on that way. I like the flexibility, and I'm sure you still have some of that going on, but even by defining it, you start to limit the way people perceive their options.
Yeah, and I think it's a good idea to include something like the role as something that, because D&D is very encounter-based, and they've got a formula that works for them and a formula that a lot of people like. So, I mean, I think specifying role as a box you need to fill on your character sheet is good, but I would be concerned if those are tied to specific classes.
Right, and it's my idea that they are pretty well tied to specific classes, that each class has a role and a power source, which is our next note there, that they've divided power sources into arcane, divine, and martial power sources.
If I could just make one more comment about roles.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they've got, like, again, everything's very, seems to be very combat-based, like, you know, leader, defender, striker, controller. I mean, I hope they're planning to include things like, you know, negotiator or researcher.
Well,
or...
and I'm not sure, but I think some of that goes into the leader role. The leader is sort of your diplomat in the group. I think that's the charismatic role.
Fair enough.
So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of them do seem to be very combat-based. I mean, the defender is obviously, that's a combat role. Striker is definitely a combat role.
Like, I think of the A-team, you know. I mean, you had, I mean, I'm assuming you watched the A-team.
In my youth.
Yeah, so you've got guys like Hannibal. You know, he was the de facto leader. But when they needed a smooth talker to, you know, get a lady on their side, they went to Face Man. When they needed someone knocked out, they went to BA. You know, and it's like all those guys had aspects of leadership. They were just, you know, within certain contexts.
Right. And then, as I understand it, and from reading some of the articles, if you take all of the roles, leader, defender, striker, and controller, and make a grid with those at the top, then you can make the power sources down the side, arcane, divine, and martial, and there's one class that's supposed to fit into each of those little boxes. So they've designed a leader with martial abilities, a defender with martial abilities, a striker with martial abilities, a controller with martial abilities. And then they go again and say, okay, leader with divine, and on and on and on. And so there's supposed to be classes that fit into all of those roles combined with all of those power sources. Although some of them won't be out, it doesn't sound like, with the player's handbook this year or next year.
Right.
And so, again, I mean, that seems to, in my mind, even more push the idea that these roles are going to be limiting. Now, maybe I've found that sometimes that's a little misleading, because they have had a history of push, you know, really talking a lot about this, about certain ideas, but it doesn't turn out to be necessarily that crucial to the game. You know, the idea of roles might be something they're really talking about because it's at the forefront of their minds as a design concept. But when you actually get down and play the game, it's just an idea that's out there, and it's not really an issue as far as any of the rules or any of that goes anyway.
Yeah, and it can be just as well, I won't say limiting, but it can be just as bad the other way, because if you open everything up, then there's nothing that makes characters unique. I mean, I played AD&D in its first edition, and, you know, if you weren't a thief, which is what they called rogues back then,
yeah,
if you weren't a thief, you couldn't pick locks.
Right.
You know, and although that made it very interesting when it came down to your party selection, what you could do, it almost didn't make sense. Okay, like maybe, you know, the fighter's not as good at picking locks, but at least you had somebody that could. And they almost went to the opposite extreme in second edition and even third edition, where, you know, everybody can do almost everything. So
yeah,
I guess it's a balance.
And I hadn't really thought of that, but that's really a good thing to point out, that some of this might be just they swung the pendulum so far in one direction for third edition that now they're just swinging back a little bit. Maybe they're not giving up all of what third edition had to offer in flexibility, but they're trying to give some of that idea of some characters can do things and there's just simply better at it than others, and trying to accentuate that more to make the different classes more unique.
And we're just two guys talking. I mean, they're a big company that I'm sure makes good use of market research. Maybe the market research is telling them that people wanted things this way.
Maybe that's true. It's hard to tell where the population is when you get most of your information from the internet, because that's a very self-selected sample of people who are speaking very loudly in that world.
The other thing that I always have to remind myself of is, because, you know, looking down these lists, you know, I find things that I like and find things that I don't. But the thing that I try to keep foremost in my mind is that the one thing that I think fourth edition is really trying to do, based on what I've read and heard, is similar to what White Wolf did in the early 90s with the original World of Darkness games, was to bring people into the role-playing game, the pen and paper role-playing game hobby, that weren't into that hobby before. So maybe they're trying to make it simple so that people that don't have this 15-20 year gaming history, like a lot of us that record and listen to these podcasts, so maybe they're trying to meet them at the point where this is a hobby that they feel like taking up. I mean, there's nothing right. more intimidating than when you're trying to get into a new game, whether it's a role-playing game or a video game, is, you know, seeing a stack of rules so complex that it's not even worth investing your time.
Yeah, and it's a careful balance, because you want to, you obviously they have to, as a company, bring in new people or else they shrivel up and die, and at the same time you don't want to give up your base. And so it's a careful balance, and I'm sure that they're doing their best to make sure that they're trying to make as many people as happy as possible, because after all, that's the business that they're in. So let's go through and look at what classes are in with the new edition. So real quick, the classes that we're looking at for 4th edition are Fighter, which we have some information about to talk about later, Rogue, Paladin, which is later on our list also, Wizard, we have a lot to talk about with the magic system, Cleric, Warlord is a new one that we haven't seen before, which is, as I understand, is your... is your leader role. This is the one who, the martial character who fills the leadership role in the party, that has abilities to not only wade into combat and fight, but also to successfully give bonuses to the rest of the party as their leader. The Ranger is coming back. The Warlock has made it into the core for the new edition, as well as Sorcerer. The Bard is not looking like it's going to be core. It's not going to be in the player's handbook, but it will be showing up at some point, I'm told, and when it does, it will fill that leadership role. Same thing with the Sword Mage. Not going to be in the player's handbook, but shortly after that is going to come out, filling the Defender role. And the idea behind the Sword Mage is they use their spells in order to help them fight better. I know that that one was brought up specifically because there's a novel coming out about a sword mage that's coming out around the time of 4th edition.
Ah, okay.
So that's why that one even got mentioned, I think, because the author who's working on that novel says, like, yes, yes, I know, none of you know what any of this is all about, but the sword mage is a class, it's coming out, it just won't be in the players.
So is the Warlock basically like a necromancer type class?
The Warlock is one of those things that was tried out in 3.5 with Complete Arcane, if I'm remembering right. And it's it was a class that came out there, and the idea was that they had some sort of fiendish heritage.
Oh, okay.
Or made some sort of pact with you know, some sort of evil creatures. And they get magical abilities from that. And basically they had less options than like a wizard would have. And they may not be as powerful as a normal wizard or sorcerer or spell. But their abilities were things that never ran out. It was all at will. And so
right.
they could throw these eldritch blasts around and they would have different effects and they could do all of their abilities at will. They just weren't quite as powerful, so they would never run out, which is, of course, one of the big deals for 4th edition, is that no matter how long you go in a day in a adventuring party, you don't run out of things to do in a fight.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how they accomplish that, just because that's such a departure from just the play style that the game's always had. I mean, they mentioned in their own podcast how you know, you basically get to, you know, I think they jokingly refer to it as, you know, the end of the adventuring day, you know, after an hour.
Right.
Because the cleric and or wizard is out of spells. So it'll be interesting to see how they implement that, because that's going to be, for existing players of the game, that's going to be a real shift in thinking.
I think it's going to be a shift in thinking, but I don't think it's going to be a negative shift in thinking, because honestly, that's one of the things that never has logically made a lot of sense to me. You know, I always picture an in my head, if I was writing it as a book or whatever, an adventuring party goes down into the dungeon and they go and they go and they go until they just can't go anymore because they've been beaten up so bad, and then they take a rest. They don't take a rest when everybody's healthy and doing fine because somebody ran out of spells, you know?
So, yeah, it's a little counterintuitive, and there's right. probably other gaming systems that have done a better job of that.
Right. So and we'll talk a little bit more about that
yeah.
specific idea when we get later on into another section, because I know I've got some more information about this concept. The rogue is all about having abilities to hurt other creatures. They're better at confirming criticals. They get more attacks of opportunity. And of course, attacks of opportunity and those kinds of things are going to see some pretty significant change, as I understand it. And so the rogue's all about being able to hurt certain creatures more than your other classes.
See, that was strange to me when I read it, because when I think of the rogue, I think of the sort of the ultra versatile, many skills, always knows what to do within a certain situation. I never really thought of them as a combat class. I mean, yes, they did have the sneak attack and right. the, you know, bonus damage that way, but I sort of thought of that as more out of the fact that because they were weak in a stand-up fight, they had to resort to that, as opposed to it being something that they, you know, studied and got good at.
Right, and I've always sort of seen them. They're sort of the swashbuckling class of all the at least in third edition, of all the classes, because they've got the high skills and they're really versatile, and they can jump from one thing to the next and be decent at all of them, and they have to be creative in order to do well and that kind of stuff. I can sort of see, like, the attacks of opportunity. That makes sense to me for a rogue. Because it's about versatility and being able to act in the moment. And I think the whole issue with the confirming criticals is more in a response to the fact that in third edition some creatures aren't hurt by criticals. Like
right.
like your elementals and your constructs and your undead and that kind of stuff. And I wonder if they're not saying that at least a rogue is actually going to be able to crit some of those creatures, and when they do get a critical, it'll be easier for them to actually confirm that critical. They'll get some bonuses maybe to confirming the critical, so that when they do hit well, they do it more often, I guess.
I guess, yeah, because they have the knowledge to know where to hit and how to hit and what to hit it with.
Right.
Criticals could be a podcast all unto itself.
Yeah. On the subject of paladins, and we might jump around a little bit here because some of the things have changed as I've written one thing. I've gone further down and there's some new information about it. But paladins no longer are lawful good. There's no longer that restriction on paladins.
I don't like that.
Don't you?
I don't like that at all. To me, a paladin is, you know, is so iconic and such a, you know, a narrowly focused class that, you know, I don't know. To me, when you cease to be lawful good, you cease to be a paladin. And a lot of people that I've seen and read sort of feel that the lawful good alignment was this big handcuff, but I didn't think so. I mean, all that the lawful good portion of a paladin to me ever really did was pigeonhole the legalism under which the paladin existed. I mean, just because you're lawful good, I mean, lawful good characters make great jerks. I mean, you could be a lawful good paladin and follow all the rules of being a paladin, but you could be self-righteous and snobby and just a real jerk about it. And that's something that I never really saw in my own experience, a lot of people taking the opportunity to embrace. And if I read between the lines, I sort of get the impression that taking away the lawful good restriction is done so that it could free up the class. But, you know, I think it always had that freedom.
Well, I think the idea behind the lawful good restriction disappearing is that it frees up the class so that now more people can, more, I guess, deities or whatever can have holy warriors. Because the paladin that they're looking at, I think, is just you are now a holy warrior. That's what a paladin is. You could be a holy warrior of this horrible evil creature, or you could be a holy warrior of your bright and shining good god or whatever it is. But, you know, Loth is just as likely to have a paladin as Tyr or whoever. Of course, I go back to my Forgotten Realms roots and mention gods from that setting, but you get the idea. I mean, I think that's the whole concept, is that you can have evil, chaotic, good, lawful, neutral, whatever gods that have holy warriors that stand up and represent their ideals.
I guess it's just I don't know, the word holy in and of itself implies to me, you know, I mean, that's you know, a word that only really has meaning when it's held in contrast to an absolute. So, you know, to have a holy neutral warrior, that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I guess if you think about it, I think the other option is if you wanted to have a warrior that represented other ideals, you know, chaotic, evil, or whatever they be, it seems that the other option is to create a new class for each and every one of them. And it was just easier to say that, let's just open up the paladin and make it an option for anybody.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of what I've always liked about classes like that is that you have something that's unique for a specific alignment or worldview. Because by contrast, I mean, okay, you could say you want something that has the, for lack of a better phrase, religious significance of a paladin for chaotic evil. But you couldn't really, along that same line of thinking, like, you couldn't open up an assassin that way. You couldn't open up a necromancer really that way. So it's just interesting. And, you know, this gets into philosophical debates that, you know, we probably don't want to delve too deep into. But I just always liked it that, you know, you had some things that drew a line in the sand where you had the paladin was like, okay, you want to be, like, one of my favorite lines in that movie From Dusk Till Dawn, do you want to be a mean mother effing servant of God? Well, you know, then you have to follow by this litany of ideology.
Well, and I think some of that comes down to, it comes down to that God issue, that deity, whatever the character follows, then you're still going to have those restrictions and you're still going to have those rules and all that kind of stuff. I would imagine in my head, if I'm a paladin of a lawful good god, then my moral code and my, you know, required actions are going to be the same as the norm that we think of when we think of a paladin. And if I don't follow those, then I'm going to face the same penalties as we think of for a paladin who doesn't follow those restrictions. But that also means that these people over here who have a different worldview can also have their separate set of restrictions, their separate set of rules, and also have a class that represents them also.
So what's this point that we see next here about clerics? Clerics might get the ability to heal as they do damage.
I'm seeing some, and I'm seeing more of this as I go on, that there's...
Like, does it mean to themselves or to their...
As they do damage to in combat with other creatures. So,
but who are they healing, themselves or their party members? Or
I think both. And I think this is one of those areas where I think they've sort of play tested this idea in Book of Nine Swords. I actually just ran into this with an NPC that I ran in my game last night. Because Book of Nine Swords has some abilities where if I successfully attack somebody, I can heal my allies. Or if I successfully attack somebody, I can heal myself. And so I'm wondering if they've taken that idea and said, well, that would be perfect for a cleric.
For an evil cleric.
and the other issue with that is that I'm not exactly sure how you necessarily explain that logically. I mean, I guess it's magic, so it doesn't have to make logical sense. But
no.
On the other hand, sometimes I'd like things to make more sense to me also, even if it's in my game.
See, that would make sense to me for an evil cleric. You know, as you mete out, you know, aggression on your opponent, your god gives you a boon,
Sure.
I'd be interested to see how that worked out for, here we are back to a line that's, but how, you know, but I mean, if you were a good cleric, I could understand how your god would give you a boon if you were destroying undead.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess that's one of the things we'll have to wait and see how it plays out, because that was one of the things that they mentioned in passing, sort of in a playtest report, which is where I got that information. And so they playtested a report and said, well, yeah, this character, the cleric, hits the dragon and heals his friend at the same time. And it's like, okay, well, clearly this is something that they have the ability to do this exists, but what the requirements are and who you have to be to do that, I don't know yet.
Yeah, because, I mean, or it could be, you know, depending how you want to interpret that statement, you know, is it a vampiric kind of thing? You know,
right.
Lots of ways to interpret that.
Yeah. And the next one deals with the fighters and how they are insisting that the fighters, with all of their new maneuvers and abilities and all that kind of stuff, they're going to get more powerful and more abilities as they get further along in their training, is how they're explaining it, and that they're not becoming super-powered anime characters.
Yeah, I just, like, I wonder how that's really different from the feat system now, is my question.
And again, I think a lot of how that's different is it's drawing more on what they did with the Book of Nine Swords.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with
it. You're not familiar with it. Yeah, and see, I hadn't done much with it for a while, and then I sort of got it out because I've talked to some people that said a lot of good things about it, so I'm like, oh, I'll check it out, and I've used it a couple of times in my game now. And I can see how that works, and it's basically, it's sort of spells for fighters, is the idea. You know, they're not magic, they're not really spells, but they're special maneuvers that you can pull off so that I do extra damage, or I'm harder to trip because my stance is such that I'm grounded better, or, you know, it's things like that.
See, and when I hearken back to first edition, one of the things in third edition that I found wasn't really as, I'll say, it wasn't as special as it was in earlier editions, is that, you know, you can attack multiple times in a round as a fighter at first level, but in the older editions of D&D, you know, you had to, you know, I think it was, if I'm remembering this correctly, at fifth level, you got three attacks every two round, and boy, oh boy, when you got to that point in your career as a fighter, you know, that was something really significant, whereas
right.
There's so many different ways to attack and attack multiple times per round that I think just being able to do that kind of got decreased in significance, because practically anyone in any class could do it.
Sure. Well, and that's one, yeah, that's, and I think that's one of the things, why that's one of the reasons, I guess, that they brought this into the fourth edition, is because they saw fighters as sort of being the bland class, that it was just, okay, who are you going to attack this round? Who are you going to attack that round? How are you going to do it this time? And it's always just the fighter always has one thing to do, go up to the enemy and attack him. What they wanted to do was give the fighter more options to say, okay, well, this round you're attacking, but you're using your green dragon strike, and this round you're using your bone crusher attack and whatever. And so they have different options that have different things that they do. I think the idea was just to try to make things a little bit more interesting for that class.
I just hope they don't sort of overwhelm people with options.
Yeah, and I can see that too, because they keep talking about how they've simplified the game and made it faster to run. And at the same time, I keep seeing things getting more and more complex with issues like this. And they talk about not becoming a super-powered anime-like character, and yet at the same time, the things that I'm seeing make me think of super-powered anime-like characters, you know?
Well, and that's the flavor of D&D. I mean, it's not a game where you're just walking around as everyman. I mean, you're a superhero, for the lack of a better word. I mean, you're stronger than pretty much every normal person that you encounter. At first level, you're already a superhero. So it wouldn't bother me if all of a sudden in D&D, you know, you've got fighters doing things like in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, because to me that's consistent with the feel that D&D's always had.
And see, I've usually taken a little bit of a different approach to D&D, and My campaign settings, my worlds are sprinkled with people that also have the same abilities that are in all the classes. And so, I mean, yes, the common person, you're obviously more powerful than, but at first level, you're pretty darn close to being just a normal person. The times that you start doing the crazy kung fu martial arts stuff is when you're talking, you know, your higher level characters, at least over 10. So I guess we just take a little bit of a different approach to that, to the feel of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So it also looks like, and we'll talk more about this, that spell levels are changing. We no longer have just the standard 9 levels, but instead spell levels are going to correspond to character levels.
Boy, it only took them 30 years to do that.
Yeah, so when you're a 13th level wizard, you're going to be casting a 13th level spell.
Finally. I mean, it stuns me that it took that long. And, you know, as good as an idea as it is now, I mean, you know, why did it take that long? I mean,
right.
It just makes so much sense that if you're going to have a level-based system that, you know, an X-level character casts X-level spells.
Right. And that makes a lot of logical sense. I can see where the confusion is going to be on the issue of what makes this spell 13th level and not 12th level. You know, where do you draw that line? It's a little bit easier to do that when there's only 9 levels to deal with. When you're talking about 20 or 30 levels of power, you're getting into pretty fine distinctions.
Yeah, you're shaving you're making it pretty granular at that point. You know, what's the distinction between a 24th level spell and a 25th level spell, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, how do you define that? So yeah, that's a good point. You know, they might have made it easier on themselves if they would have, you know, only had characters go to 9 levels.
Yeah. But of course, that's no fun for anybody.
Well, I don't know about that.
People like to level. If there's only 9 of them, then you can only level so every so often.
But how much more significant would it be? You know, I mean, once you got from 3rd to 4th level, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
Because you think, I mean, when I think of people that play World of Warcraft now, I mean, what's the top level? I don't play that game, but, you know, the top level, you can be something like 60th or 70th. And, you know, people are, you know, really excited when they go from 58th to 59th level. And I'm like, well, you know, is your character really that much different?
Sure.
And they're like, well, no.
Well, and it depends on which level you've hit, right? You know, you might have very little difference between 5th level and 6th level for a character, but when they hit 7th level, they're going to add a bunch of new abilities. So some levels are more exciting than others in the current system.
For sure. And I don't know. I've always thought that if you're going to have a level-based system, because I play a lot of other games that don't, you know, that aren't as level-based or aren't level-based at all, but
sure.
I mean, to me, I mean, if you're going to have a progression, when you get that you're going to state in terms of levels, like when you achieve a new level, like that should be a big deal. And
right.
So it's interesting to me to hear the D&D creators talk about, you know, the sweet spot and how, you know, those are their words, how, you know, what currently in D&D, I think they said between 7th and 10th level is, you know, the sweet spot to play the game. And I'm just I'd be interested to know why they think that way.
Well, and the reason they think that way that they've talked about is that the information they get from people and from their own playing of the game is that the game is the most fun between those levels. That you're having more fun in those levels than you are at the earlier levels or at the later levels. Because before, you know, levels 1 through 5 or 6, you're just not powerful enough to do the cool things that you want to do. And then when you get up to, you know, your levels 12, 13, 14, then you've got so many things going on that it's just a headache to sort of keep track of it all. And so you're not having as much fun.
See, I sort of interpreted that statement to mean that, you know, once you know, the levels that you're getting up until the point you're in this so-called sweet spot are, you know, you're not really accomplishing anything significant. And then once, you know, I sort of think of it as a bell curve. And then once you get on the other half of the curve, you know, on the downward slope, you know, you're getting diminishing returns. Like, you know, gaining a level means less and less.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's part of it too. I would definitely, I think those two ideas can merged together pretty well. Because yeah, I mean, there's an element of that too. But I know at least the way I've expressed it is the way I've felt about it. Because I think my sweet spot is somewhere between 6 and 12. I have a lot of fun playing games in between those levels. But earlier than that, it's like, okay, well, you're too weak to do a lot of the things that I want to do in a game. And later on, it's just, you know, above, you know, 13 and above, it's just like, okay, now it's starting to be a headache to keep track of what spells are still running and what are the bonuses and what are my stats now? What are my stats going to be in 5 minutes? Who cares? So that's sort of my approach to it, because I felt the same way before they even started talking about a sweet spot. I was sort of feeling like, you know, I don't want to play high level games. It's just too much of a pain sometimes.
Interesting.
So our next note deals with warlocks, and we've talked a little bit about what warlocks are, and along with their connection to, I guess, outsiders and what was called outsiders and the afterlife and all that kind of stuff. One of the things we've learned is they have a Boon of Souls ability. So whenever they send an enemy off to the afterlife, presumably meaning that they've killed them, they actually get benefits. They get bonuses for that. So whenever they've sent a soul off to the afterlife, they actually get some sort of benefits to that some sort of buffs to their abilities as that happens. And then they also are able to curse people and cause have a negative impact on other people.
So I guess warlocks will really hate fighting golems.
Yes. and I suppose some undead that don't have souls either, I suppose. They wouldn't get the benefit for that.
I mean, you're getting really philosophical here. Yeah. I mean, you know, in your games, you know, do wild animals have souls? You know.
Ah.
I mean, you know, I've got my tongue in my cheek a bit, but that'll be really interesting.
That will be. You're going to hear a lot of rules lawyers talking about that.
Yeah. The evangelism of, you know, woodland adventures. No warlocks are going to want to adventure there because they can't get their boons.
Right. The next thing that we have on the list is about the epic levels. Epic is now core, meaning it's going to be in the player's handbook. They're taking the original 20 levels that was already in the player's handbook, and they're adding on the 10 levels that we have previously called epic. So they're not saying that we're just going to take your 20 levels of power and shrink it down a little bit more and do 30 levels instead. They're actually saying we're going to tack 10 levels on it on the back end, so you can, you know, the things that used to be in the epic level handbook will now just be in the player's handbook, and everybody will be able to do that. Although they did also mention that they're trying to make it a little bit faster to level, since, again, people have expressed that they like the process of leveling their character. They said, okay, well, let's do that more often then. So there is some of that going on also.
Yeah, the one thing that I've wondered about, and, you know, maybe it's a lack of my own exposure, but, you know, if people like leveling and like playing at that high power level, I mean, it's interesting to me that in the core rules, as I understand them, and maybe I'm wrong here, but, you know, there's not a lot said about, you know, there's sort of this cradle to grave treatment of your character. Like, you know, you have to start at first level and, you know, slog through and you know, earn those levels. But, you know, so many other games I see, you know, they provide different starting points. Like, okay, if you want to really develop the character from square one, you know, and sticking in D&D terminology, you know, start at first level. But I'm just surprised there's not more, you know, it's interesting to me to hear the comment and say, oh, well, you know, there'll be 30 levels in the core set, but you'll level faster. Well, you know, I'm just curious as to why they don't just even provide the idea of, you know, starting at, you know, what they're calling Paragon and Epic level, if that's where you really want to play.
Well, I think you can. I mean, they even in third edition.
Oh, of course you can.
They've provided the necessary numbers and information to start at higher levels. I don't know. Again, it goes back to this idea of the sweet spot in my mind is that if I start a character from levels 10 and above in third edition, I'm starting the game off a little bit lost, you know? Whereas if I start at a lower level and work my way up, okay, I've played with this ability for a while. I know how it works. Now I'm ready to add another level and add a couple of new abilities and sort of play with those and get to know how those work. And so the higher levels are a little bit easier to digest as a player if I've sort of worked my way up to it. Plus, there's always the sense of accomplishment that, hey, I've been playing this guy for ages. He used to be this little nothing, and now he's, you know, a god.
I guess it depends on, you know, the frequency and, you know, how long you want the horizon of your campaign to be. Sure. And that, I guess, depends on, you know, all the real life factors that go into that.
Right. The next note we have is about multiclassing, and multiclassing is going to be working a little bit differently in 4th edition. They say that if you're a fighter wizard, you're not going to be just half a fighter and half a wizard. They're going to, it sounds like, find some way to sort of power that up a little bit.
Didn't they try that?
In what?
In the current 3.5, I mean, I'm drawing a blank on the book, but you basically had a way to start as like a half-level fighter, half-level wizard or whatever you wanted to be? Or is that what they're saying they want to get away from?
Well, what they're saying they want to do is they want to say you can be a fighter wizard, but not be a wizard that's so weak that your wizard abilities don't really mean anything. Because, like, if we're playing in a group of 12th level characters, and I'm 6 levels of fighter and 6 levels of wizard, I'm, compared to everybody else, I'm a pretty crappy wizard. And it may not even be worth it for me to have those wizard abilities anymore. In a lot of ways, they're saying multiclassing in 3rd edition is not very attractive. In some cases, there's just not a lot of good reasons to do it. But in 4th edition, they're going to make it so that there are good reasons to do it, and you're not going to be a weaker wizard just because you also took some fighter levels.
Well, see, to me, that speaks to a problem with the way they've balanced things then, because if they're trying to present levels as something more or less linear, then, you know, a 6-level fighter plus a 6-level wizard should equal a 12th-level character. So I would lob the ball back in their court and say, you know, there's design flaws if your system's not accommodating that, or your level progression isn't linear, which is fine too.
Right, and this is exactly my issue with the whole thing. Also, is that I'm a little concerned with, does that mean that it's going to, that my fighter wizard is now going to be more powerful than everybody else because I get a bunch of abilities higher than the 6 levels of wizard and higher than the 6 levels of fighter combined?
Exactly. Like, I mean, I don't see if they're concerned that it's, you know, not balanced the way it is now. I mean, if, you know, to use a pendulum swing analogy we had earlier, I mean, is it just flipping it?
Yeah.
And then having it so that, you know, nobody's going to do anything except play multi-class characters.
Right. And I wonder if the way they're going to maybe approach this is to maybe keep it pretty close to 3rd edition, but have your spells and abilities be dependent on character level rather than class level. So your 12th level fighter wizard can still throw a 12d6 fireball, although that's not going to be happening either, but we'll talk later about that. But you can still throw your 12d6 fireball because you have 12 character levels, even though you only have 6 wizard levels. And so you're still a significantly strong wizard. I wonder if that's not how the approach they're taking to it.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those wait and sees, right?
Right.
Yeah.
The idea of prestige classes is changing, but there's going to be something that's very similar in 4th edition. I haven't heard yet what I've read some places, but they're not official sources, that they've decided to just go ahead and call it prestige classes again. Earlier reports were saying that they weren't going to have prestige classes, but there was going to be something else going on that was very similar to the prestige class that sort of filled that niche in the game.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I really liked the idea in 3.5 of prestige classes, because I'm a big fan of themes in a role-playing game. Like, you know, I don't tend to, at least not at this point, I mean, maybe when I was in high school, you know, it was all about min-maxing and getting the most abilities and being able to do the most damage. But, sure. You know, I'm, you know, in my 30s now, more interested in, you know, storytelling and having compelling characters. And, you know, reading through some of the prestige classes, you know, a lot of the time, you know, in terms of the straight numbers on the page, I mean, you'd be better off sticking with the core classes. But I really liked the way that the prestige classes would give you a narrow focus. I mean, one of my favorite ones was the, I think it was in Complete Warrior, was the Eye of Grumsh. Just a really a flavor-filled, very, you know, specific way to hone your fighter and or barbarian. And just I just really liked the fact that a lot of the prestige classes were just that. They were a way to really put system rules around a theme you wanted for your character. I mean, they might have gone overboard with the sheer number and options of prestige right. classes, but I'm glad to hear that they're keeping that a part of D&D.
Well, and that concept I think has been around in D&D for a long time, because I've equated third edition prestige classes to being about the same as second edition kits.
I skipped second edition. So.
No, see, they had kits in second edition, so yeah. you could add this kit to your fighter, and it gave you certain benefits and certain disadvantages. But what it really did is added a whole different flavor to the character, and it didn't change or progress as you leveled up. It was just a one time. Okay, you now get a plus to this and a minus to that, or you now can do this ability and not this ability. But there was this whole flavor behind it that sort of gave a lot of that fluff that you were talking about.
A lot of the time in my own games, I don't allow, given the diversity and breadth of the number of prestige classes available in 3.5, a lot of the time I don't allow multi-classing in my own games just as a house rule, just because there is that way to, you know, give your character an ability without giving them an identity crisis.
Right.
So I'm excited to hear that they're keeping that.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. Like we've said, I like the idea of being able to personalize things and to give it a focus in that way. When we were talking about paladins earlier, it actually occurred to me that why not just make paladins a prestige class? You know,
that would be a good solution. An excellent solution.
I think that would be a fabulous solution, because prestige classes are all about the flavor, and paladins are really paladins because of the flavor. So why not just get rid of paladins as a core class and make it a prestige class? Makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. Wonder why I didn't say that. You must be smarter than me.
That's it. I'll take credit for that. So our next note deals with the powers that different classes get, and how every class is supposed to now have powers that you can use at will, powers that you can use every encounter, and then powers that you can use every day.
Now, obviously, the arcane and divine, I mean, those are magical. I mean, are the, what they're calling, I guess, the martial powers, like, are those going to be magical or considered magical?
The idea is that these powers will be based off of your martial training and the work that you've done with your body and that kind of stuff, and your fighting skills, and completely non-magical.
Because one thing that I thought when I read that there'd be martial powers was that they were sort of circumventing the whole, you know, this creature can only be hit by magical attacks kind of thing. But I guess that's not, at least they haven't come out and said that's what it's
No, I think it's going to be different than that. And again, this is where I think they're pulling heavily from the Book of Nine Swords. And so those people who are familiar with the Book of Nine Swords, it's going to look a lot like that, I think. Because that is full of abilities that you can use per encounter, which is something that never really existed, you know, before, until the Book of Nine Swords came out, in a lot of ways. I mean, you saw at-will abilities before, you saw per-day abilities before, but you never saw abilities that you could do every encounter. Because it's kind of hard to define sometimes, when does one encounter end and another one begin? And I'm seeing that in 4th edition, I think you're going to have a lot of arguments about that in your game sessions. But I think that's where they're getting those ideas.
Yeah, and always, as a player, you know, I can always remember, when you get that cool once per day ability, you know, you think, okay, well, you know, should I use it now? Should I use it now? And because you don't know what's coming, or, you know, what the rest of the day is going to bring, you know, you'll be so reluctant to squeeze the trigger on this cool ability that you have that you rarely end up using it.
Right. And I think this is one of the things where they talk about, and we'll talk more about it when we get to magic, but when we talk about, wizards not running out of spells, I think this is exactly how they're doing it, is that some of those abilities they're going to be able to use every encounter, you know. They will have spells that they can use once a day and then they're gone, but they'll have other abilities and other spells that they can use every encounter that they go into once, but then it's gone. So they've always got something to do.
Right.
And then our last note under classes, and we really probably should have talked about it earlier when we talked about paladins, because it's all about the paladin, but it got towards the end here because it just came out this week, deals with the idea of the smite. And they had an article about how smite was going to work now. That's been decided. It looks very much like maneuvers from the Book of Nine Swords again, where you can you can choose different kinds of smites and they have different kinds of effects, and you can use one smite every encounter. And so one smite might be I hit my enemy and it does extra damage. One smite might be I hit them and they're stunned, or I hit them and they're blinded, or I hit them and I'm healed, or whatever it might be. But I have that ability once per encounter, for the entire day.
Right.
And that's the last of our bits of information about classes. And I think, and I know we've been on for, what, an hour, and we've only gotten through one section, but it was a longer section, and I think a lot of the stuff that we covered in that first section is going to come up again, you know? And so we've already sort of hit it, so I think it'll actually speed up a little bit as we go on. Well, that's Chris and I talking about 4th edition classes. As always, I urge and welcome listeners to help the show in any way you can, and one of the best ways is to participate, sending your emails or audio comments to thetomeshow@gmail.com, or let me know if you're interested in reporting for the show regularly. You can also dig the show at dig.com, vote for us on Podcast Alley, or leave an iTunes review. All of these things help the show get noticed, and I really appreciate that. This information, the forum, and more can be found at the website at www.thetomeshow.com. Also, don't forget to check out the Tome's partner podcast, Fistful of Comics and Games, at www.fistfulofcomics.com for all sorts of geeky goodness. I've just recently listened to them chatting about anime, so if that's your thing, go check them out. And of course, don't forget Gamers Haven at www.canadiancrusaders.com for some great GMly advice. This has been episode 37, 4th edition classes of
The Tome.